الرحمن الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين. لا حول ولا قوة إلا بالله العلي العظيم، والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين وخاتم النبيين وسيد المرسلين أبي القاسم محمد. وعلى آل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المظلومين، ولعن الله الدائم على أعدائهم أجمعين من ليلتنا هذه إلى قيام يوم الدين. Respected علماء، elders, brothers, sisters in Islam and Iman, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. We've gathered here for the commemoration of the majlis of Abu Abdullah al-Husayn and the noble martyrs who are buried with Imam Husayn alayhi salam, in order to attract the special mercy of Allah to this gathering and the special attention of the Imam of our time. Can I request you to recite a beautiful united salawat ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. In a number of traditions from the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, there is a title which is given to Imam Husayn alayhi salam, which is one of the unique titles of Imam Husayn. And this title is Qatilul Abara, or Qatilul Abarat. We don't have a record of any of the other Qatils, those who were killed, those who were martyred in the way of Allah, as being called Qatilul Abara. This is unique to Imam Husayn alayhi salam. And the literal meaning of it is the one who was killed for the tear or the tears. Now, the deeper meanings, there are many that the ulama have expounded upon and explained. But in one of the traditions where Imam Husayn alayhi salam himself introduces himself as Qatilul Abara, he explains one meaning of it. He says that there is no mu'min, there is no believer, whether it be a male or a female, if they should hear my name, but that tears should enter their eyes. And the ulama have explained to us that one of the ways of measuring our iman, a way of sort of putting a litmus test for it, to see where we are in this struggle between haq and batil, to see where our spiritual condition is to ask ourselves what happens inside of us when we hear the name of Husayn alayhi salam. Our hope is that these hard hearts of ours in these nights of Muharram, as we come and we commemorate and we remember these tragedies, this be a way for the hardness to be softened with the tears, and for the mercy of Allah to flow by remembering the message of Imam Husayn alayhi salam. The topic that we began last night was the topic of looking and trying to see things through the lens of Imam Husayn alayhi salam. When we look at the words and the actions of Imam Husayn alayhi salam, we see that in many instances he takes a concept which is known to the people in one way and he treats it in a different way. He tries to explain the reality of it. Last night, we looked at the term Islam and how Imam Husayn alayhi salam was struggling to advocate a pure version of Islam, one that is comprehensive, one that is balanced, one that doesn't ignore the social and political dimension, one that is encompassing. And how the people at the time were using Islam as a guise to deviate the people. Tonight we'd like to look at a different aspect and something that inshallah we can take a practical lesson for in our lives. The inspiration from this comes from a letter that Imam Hussein alayhi salam wrote to the Basrans. Basra was a very important city at the time of the Qiyam of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. It was a city in which there were many of the followers of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. There were also some of the enemies of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. And Imam Hussein alayhi salam, in his duty, performing his duty as the Imam of all, he invites them to join his cause. And he says to them, "Inni ad'ukum ila Allahi," I invite you to Allah and to the Messenger. And then he says that, فَإِنَّ السُنَّةَ قَدْ أُمِيتَتْ, the sunnah of the Prophet has died. فَإِنْ تُجِيبُ دَعْوَتِ, if you answer my call, وَتُطِيعُ أَمْرِي, and you obey me, أَهْدِكُمْ سَبِيلَ الرَّشَادِ, I will guide you to the path of righteousness. I will guide you to the correct path. This last three words, أَهْدِكُمْ سَبِيلَ الرَّشَادِ, I know the brothers and sisters are lovers of the Qur'an, because a lover of Imam Hussein alayhi salam is a lover of the Kitab of Allah as well. And they would recognize this phrase from the Qur'an. And it's very interesting that Imam Hussein alayhi salam uses this phrase in other places in the journey as well. Other places in the struggle and in the way to Karbala as well. One of the instances where he uses the same phrase is on the day of Ashura itself. You would think that on the day of Ashura, when Imam Hussein alayhi salam is surrounded by the enemy and it's very clear what the conclusion is going to be, that he would just simply surrender and just fight the battle. But we see that that's not the case. On the day of Ashura, Imam Hussein alayhi salam constantly was going to the people, trying to convey to them the truth, trying to present to them the reality of the situation, to remove the veil that was covering their eyes, to break through the hardness of their hearts. And in one of those cases, when he's speaking to them, instead of listening to him, they disrespect him. They make a lot of noise. And he turns away from them in disappointment. It's one of the sad scenes from the day of Ashura. Normally, you know, we cover the martyrdoms, and those are the sad scenes, but this is one of those sad scenes where it's the rejection of the people. Imagine the Imam of the time is speaking, and the people turn away from him, and they don't want to listen to him. So what he says to them, he says, وَيْلَكُمْ مَا عَلَيْكُمْ أَن تُنْصِتُوا إِلَيَّ, what's wrong with you? Why don't you just listen to me? فَتَسْمَعُوا قَوْلِي, just hear me out. Give me a chance to convey to you my words. وَإِنَّمَا أَدْعُوكُمْ إِلَى سَبِيلَ الرَّشَادِ, again the same phrase. Indeed, I guide you to the path of rashad, the path of righteousness. Now, this is key here, because inshallah we're going to focus on this in the course of the lecture tonight. This phrase is something, as I said, from the Qur'an. And Imam Hussein alayhi salam is employing Qur'anic language. He's using the words of the Qur'an to be able to get to the people. Which story is it from? Do you recognize it? It's from the story of the mu'min of Ali Fir'aun. If you go back in the Qur'an has this incredible story of one of the Shias of Nabi Musa alayhi salam. One of those really pure, dedicated, you know, loyal followers of Musa alayhi salam, who was willing to give up everything in order to make sure that he did what was right. And he was from the clan of Fir'aun. He was from the inner circle of them. But yet when he heard the message of Nabi Musa alayhi salam, he realized that this is where the truth lies. And when he saw that they were gathering and perhaps they wanted to kill Nabi Musa alayhi salam, he felt that it was his duty to speak up. So when he goes to the people, in Surah Ghafir, Allah says that وَقَالَ الَّذِي آمَنَ, and the one who believed, the one from the people of Fir'aun who believed in Nabi Musa, يَا قَوْمِ أَتَّبِعُونِ أَهْدِكُمْ سَبِيلَ الرَّشَادِ, O my people, follow me and I will guide you to the path of righteousness. Now brothers and sisters, notice that this is not a prophet who is speaking. It is an ordinary believer, it's not a ma'asum. An ordinary believer is going to his people and he's telling them that you listen to me, let me guide you to the path of righteousness. Now what does it mean for him to guide them? That righteousness and that path lies with Nabi Musa alayhi salam. But he was going to take them and guide them to Nabi Musa alayhi salam, to the Imam, quote unquote, of his time, to the leader of his time, to the Prophet of his time. He was going to do that duty. And this is what This is why he approached his people. Brothers and sisters, when we take it, these verses and we take these quotes from Imam Hussein al-Salam into account and we analyze them, we think about them, one of the points that comes to us is that we realize that one of the goals of Imam Hussein alayhi salam from the beginning to the end was to see what he could do to guide people to the path of truth. One of his missions, one of his desires of his heart was when he saw people being misguided, he felt it was his duty to reach out to them and pull them towards Allah Ta'ala. In the society we live in, mostly, typically, the attitude is something which is different. When we interact with other people, most of the time, the interaction is a very simple and very sort of, you know, like basically, you know, let me just get my business done. Let me just take care of things that I need to do. I was talking to somebody recently who works in a convenience store. He was telling me that, look it, there's no room for me to talk about faith. There's no room for me to talk about God and the path to God. After all, everyone has their own path that they've chosen in life. Why should I bring up these type of matters? Let everyone be and do whatever they want to, and we'll just get along. A lot of times, the type of interaction that we have with the general public or we have with each other, it doesn't go to these types of issues. It's just something where, okay, if I can benefit you in some way, for example, let's say you can help me in my business or my career or my education, then I'll interact with you. But otherwise, it's like, hi, how's it going? Assalamu alaikum, alaikum salam, how are you doing? And then we just move along. But what we learn from this example of Imam Hussein alayhi salam is that his life was dedicated to seeing how he could take people to sabil al-rashad, the path of righteousness, the path of truth. The mu'min of Ali Fir'aun also, he senses this duty as well to go to his people and to guide them to the path of righteousness. Now brothers and sisters, when we want to take this example and apply it practically to our lives, I want to speak about it from three perspectives. One of them is when it comes to our spouses, those of us who are married, those of us who are thinking about being married. After all, marriage is something which is one of the institutions which is beloved to Allah. And it's something that we can always work on trying to improve and learn about. I want to speak about that. I want to speak about when it comes to children and when it comes to the general society. If you can, inshallah, help me with the salawat on Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. One of our marajid, when it comes to advice that he was giving people who are getting married, he had this one phrase that he mentioned that was very, very significant. He says that when you get married to somebody, your goal should be to take your spouse to heaven. And I remember ever since I came across that phrase, it's something that really has found a place in my heart. Because when we take that philosophy and we compare it to the typical secular philosophy for marriage, why do you get married? Because it's fun, right? That person, from a worldly, materialistic perspective, I find pleasure in the company of that person. That person makes me laugh, whatever it is, right? But typically, there's no mention of this concept that my goal is to take somebody to heaven. That's something which is very lofty. That's something which is in line with this philosophy of Abu Abdullah al-Husayn alayhi salam, sabil al-rashad. There's a very beautiful hadith that we have that's narrated from Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wa alayhi. He says, may Allah have mercy on that man who wakes up in the morning for the night prayer. He does his wudu, he begins to pray, and then he goes to his wife and he wakes her up as well. And if she doesn't wake up, and he takes some water and he sprinkles it on her face so that she wakes up. Okay, and then, you know, sometimes, you know, like, because I'm a male speaker, sometimes, you know, like, I get some feedback, they say that, why do you, you know, favor the males? In this case, no, it's not like that. The hadith continues, may Allah have mercy on that woman who wakes up for the night prayer. She does wudu, she does her salah, and she sees that her husband is sleeping. She wakes him up, and when he doesn't wake up, she takes some water and she sprinkles it on her face in order to wake him up for the salah. This is a hadith which is mentioned from Rasulullah. Now please, brothers and sisters, like, make sure you listen to the rest of it, because I don't want it to be the case that tomorrow people call and say that, you know, I was sleeping at night and suddenly I felt all this water being splashed on my face. It's not allowed to, you know, trouble somebody in to like sort of torment them in order to wake them up for the salah. We're not allowed to just take water and just dump it on somebody's face. Obviously, in this case, Rasulullah is talking about somebody who has prior permission. They've kind of, you know, organized and coordinated, and they made a pact that we're going to wake each other up for the salah, even if it means that we have to splash water on each other's faces. Now, brothers and sisters, what is Rasulullah referring to here? It's this concept that when we get married, our goal is to take each other to heaven. Our goal is to see what we can do in terms of our interaction, in terms of the model that we present to our spouse, in order to see what we can do to help them on their journey to Allah. And this is one of the things that we see from Karbala itself. You all know the story of Zuhair ibn Qayyim. Zuhair was somebody who was reluctant to join Imam Hussein alayhi salam. These are the beautiful stories. You know, I'm saying them, and we need to capture these stories and make them be part of our culture. And for our young people here, these are the stories that, you know, give us life. Zuhair ibn Qayyim was somebody who was not a follower of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. He was somebody who was inclined towards the Khulafa before Imam Ali alayhi salam, in particular Uthman. But Imam Hussein alayhi salam had a plan for him. He knew that Zuhair had potential. And so it just so happened, Zuhair was trying to escape Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Wherever Imam Hussein, they happened to be traveling in the same direction. Whenever Imam Hussein alayhi salam's caravan would set, he would make sure to go somewhere else. And then, you know, he was kind of trying to avoid him. But eventually, they ended up in the same place. And Imam Hussein alayhi salam sends a messenger to Zuhair and says that, come and meet me. And of course, Zuhair is reluctant. He says, I don't want to go. What is it that saves Zuhair? What is that means by which Zuhair finds the path to being one of the commanders in the army of Imam Hussein alayhi salam? It's his wife. According to the report, his wife, whose name is mentioned as Dulham, she says, أَيَبْعَثُ إِلَيْكَ بْنُ رَسُولِ اللَّهِ ثُمَّ لَا تَأْتِيهِ. The son of the messenger of God is calling you and you're not going to go see him? Subhanallah, glory be to Allah. لو أتيته, let's go to see him and hear him out, see what he has to say. And as soon as he gets this push from his wife, he goes. And when he comes back, it's as if the whole world has changed for him. He's smiling, he's freed from those fetters of the past false idols that he used to worship. And Zuhair becomes one of the devout followers of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. One of those who gives his life protecting the Imam. This is one of the messages that we have when we come to these majalis of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, that this is the principle upon which our marriages should revolve. When it comes to our children as well, brothers and sisters, we have a responsibility towards our children. One of the things that really scares me sometimes, alhamdulillah, I get a chance to interact with a lot of children and a lot of youth almost on a daily basis, and with their parents as well. One of the things that really scares me is a trend that I'm seeing of parents not parenting anymore. Of parents looking at the responsibility of parenting and thinking that parenting involves simply making sure that I provided materially for my children and pretty much that's all that I need to do. But when we look at what the responsibility of a parent is when it comes to a child, it's something which is much greater than that. You must have all seen before, you know, I got a chance one time to visit this one butterfly garden. I don't know if you've been to one of these. In various parts of, you know, America, Canada, they have butterfly gardens. You go there and you see thousands and thousands of butterflies that fly around. And you see them in different stages of their life cycle. And the butterfly is one of those, you know, incredible creatures of Allah Ta'ala where it goes through different stages in its life. There's one time where it's a caterpillar, and then the caterpillar, at some point, it decides to spin a cocoon over itself. Inside that cocoon, it dissolves into liquid. And then after some time, you know, you see that this cocoon is sort of opening up, and out crawls a butterfly. It's one of those, you know, miracles of nature that we can witness on a regular basis. Now, if somebody were to go to that cocoon and look at the butterfly struggling to get out and to say that, you know, I want to go and help it. I feel sorry for it. It's in that tight space. Let me go and do something to help it out. What do you think the result would be? Right? You know that if you go and do that, like pretty much that butterfly is not going to be properly formed. It's going to, you know, maybe not be able to fly, or one of its wings is going to be deformed. Part of the process that Allah created for that butterfly is that it has to struggle and go the whole way by itself in order to be able to achieve its perfection. That's the way God has designed it. But brothers and sisters, when it comes to children, Allah has designed a different system. Allah has designed a system where in order for a child to reach perfection, the parents need to be intimately involved with guiding them towards spiritual perfection. It's not enough just to give them the material means for them to be able to get into a good university, get a good degree, get a good job, get a good house and a career, and get married, and that's it. That's part of the responsibilities, at least if it's done for the sake of Allah. But there's a whole other set of responsibilities in terms of making sure that a child is going to be receiving the proper and pure instructions from the religion of Islam. That they be shown the truth, that their intellect and their rational powers be sharpened and trained so they can distinguish between truth and falsehood. There's a lot of work that a parent has to do, a lot of time they have to spend with their children. This is something which is part of أَهْدِكُمْ إِلَىٰ سَبِيلَ الرَّشَادِ, that we want to guide others to the path of righteousness. And when it comes to the people around us as well, brothers and sisters, one thing I want to do is I want to acknowledge those of you who are living here and are facing on a regular basis hostility because you are Muslim. Now, this is something which is not easy. When you take the blame for the actions of others, I was just reading an article, I don't know if you saw it. They're going to have some sort of event at the museum that has been set up for the first responders, those who first responded to 9/11. And it was a very troubling article. There was one of those first responders, you know, they're going to invite for the first time a Muslim author to speak there. And he's saying that, how dare they invite a Muslim to speak there? And he says something interesting. He says that if it wasn't rabbis who flew the planes into the World Trade Center, it wasn't ministers who flew, it was Muslims who flew the planes. And notice, it's very like this sort of logic here. If it was a rabbi, because a rabbi represents, you know, a religious figure in Judaism, then you could blame Jews. If it was a priest or a minister that represents a religious figure, so you could blame Christians. But he says it was Muslims. Now, for Muslims, he doesn't make the same thing. He said Muslims, if it's a few Muslims, that means all Muslims are to blame. Right? See the bad logic there. And then he says that, I don't want to be politically incorrect, right? But Muslims are the ones who have ruined my life. Because after he, you know, did the first response, then he had medical problems that took place. So Muslims as a whole, they're all guilty for what these hijackers did on the plane. Now, that's the reality. We're facing, you know, a lot of, you know, people who are, you know, have like, you know, illogical reasons for having prejudice and hatred against Muslims. And so I want to acknowledge those of you who are struggling against that, and you have to face that. Having said that though, one of the responsibilities we have at this time in particular is to present to the people around us what it means to be a Muslim. We need to share the beauties of our faith. We need to not be those who are trying to hide our identity, but rather ones who show people the pride that we have in being Muslim. And we might think that, okay, well, there's all these people, they have these misconceptions, and therefore they're naturally going to apply it to us as well. Yes, there will be those bigots, those people who, you know, have no sense of reason. But the majority of the people are people who are curious. They're seeking out to know. They want to meet people live who are actually Muslims. And if it's possible for us to find a way, those of us who have that ability to, you know, interact with people outside of the faith, to use this as an opportunity, a golden opportunity to present the true meaning of what it means to be a Muslim. This is part of that ideology of أَهْدِكُمْ إِلَىٰ سَبِيلَ الرَّشَادِ, that I want to guide you to the path of truth and righteousness. This is what it means to take one of the ways we can take on the message of Muhammad Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam on a practical level, that we care for other people as well. As a Muslim, I should look at those who don't have Islam, and I should be saying that I'm sorry for you that you don't have access to these incredible teachings that I have access to. Let me see what I can do to share these with you. So this is part of our responsibility. Now, how do we go about guiding others? Because I want to make this practical. You know, one of the questions we have is, let's say I want to be able to guide my spouse. I want to be able to guide my children. I want to be able to guide my friends or people that I interact with. What is the approach that I can take? Now, brothers and sisters, when it comes to the family, there's a mistake that a lot of us make. And I want to point that out tonight because, again, you know, we have to use these opportunities to make it practical. One of the mistakes that I constantly see, you know, in other families, even, you know, I can speak to myself as well too, that I am guilty of, is that a lot of the times when you want to guide somebody to the path of righteousness, the way we do so is that when we see them doing something wrong, we speak out. Right? Like, for example, let's say my son is doing something, you know, like he's doing something which I find to be, you know, not so good. So immediately I say that, okay, you know, don't do this, that's wrong. My daughter is doing something like that, I say, okay, don't do this, do not. My spouse says something, you know, or treats me in a certain way which I don't feel is appropriate, so I immediately, you know, get mad at her, I get angry. And this is the way it works. And then what happens is that, you know, you have these people who sort of feel that their responsibility is to guide people by pointing out all their flaws and their faults. They become expert at being fault finders. And family life becomes one of where, you know, anybody who comes within the radar of that person, they just look at them and it's like, okay, these are your problems. You're doing this, you're talking like this, you're eating like this, you're walking like this, and then, you know, everything collapses. Right? And you might have seen, you know, cases of this where children grow up in this type of a family, or spouses are part of this relationship, and it becomes something which is, you know, very uncomfortable. I remember when I was a child, you know, I grew up in a state where we had more snow than you guys have. I don't know if you have snow here or not. We used to have a lot of snow. And there would be these big, you know, heaps of snow. Now, I don't know with global warming whether it still happens or not, but at least at that time it was like big, huge heaps of snow. So we were kids, and we would play this game. It's called King of the Hill. You know, one of us would go to the top of the hill, and then the other children would be there, and, you know, you don't know where they're going to come from, but in any direction, somebody could come at any time, they could go and push you down from the hill. And it's not a pleasant experience to come tumbling down a hill. Right? So then you get back up again, then you have to come up, and then if you ever get there, you push other people down, you get on top, and then you go down. Now, sometimes the experience we have, and from the perspective of a child in a family, it's kind of like that. It's like whenever they get into a situation, right, they always get pushed off. They always get like told off. They always get like, you know, criticized. Right? They never find that they always be like, you know, when am I going to get, when's the next attack coming? Or sometimes from a spouse as well too. Like, when is she next going to lash out? When is he next going to criticize me? Like, you never feel that comfort and that sort of stability. And for a family to be designed with this type of a model, it's not going to be successful. It's going to create a lot of problems when it comes to the future. So how do we do? How do we take this philosophy of, on one hand, we want to guide other people, but we also want to provide them with an environment where they're going to feel that comfort and that safety and that love and that compassion. But brothers and sisters, you know, the ulama who, you know, are experts in the matter of ethics and family, one of the things they tell us is that when you want to criticize somebody, when you get upset at what somebody does to you, like in the family or with friends, you could even apply it to friends as well too, 90% of the time, you shouldn't speak out. You shouldn't act on your base impulse to actually say something to be critical and to say something negative. 90% of the time. It's 9 out of 10 times when your natural impulse is to go and, you know, like sort of lash out with your tongue, keep it. 1 out of the 10 times is it going to be appropriate. So then you might ask, well, wait a minute, isn't this whole majlis and this whole lecture about trying to guide other people to the path of righteousness? Well, how do we do that then if we're not pointing out the flaws? Well, there's other ways of doing that. There's other ways of guiding people to the path of truth and righteousness. One of them, which is very important, is to be people who show love to others. When we show our spouse, when we show our children, or even children when they show their parents that they love them and they care for them on a constant basis, if 90% of the time we're showing them that we appreciate their efforts, we're praising them on their efforts, then when it comes to that 10%, okay, they're going to be people who take that from us. Because they know that we're people who care for them. Our goal isn't just to make their life difficult. Our goal is to take them to the path of goodness and righteousness. And they feel that from us. When Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wa alayhi wanted to guide people, when he wanted to guide them to Islam, when he wanted to invite them openly to Islam, what did he first ask them? Right? Did he just come to them and say that, okay, I am, you know, so-and-so, and I'm ordering you to like follow what I tell you? He says, first of all, that if I were, according to some of the reports, if I were to tell you that an army is approaching from the other side of the mountain, would you believe me? And all of them said that, yes, you are the one who is trustworthy. You are the one who is known as the truthful. You see, he had established that relationship with the people, and then he could tell them that all these idols that you're worshipping, the path that you have chosen for yourselves in life, you know, you're worshipping your nafs, right? All of this is wrong, follow me. And that's when he's effective, because he established that relationship with them. And this is a very powerful lesson for us. When you go to the hadith of the Ahl Bayt, they say that when you notice a flaw in somebody, and this is very practical advice that you can take tonight and apply it in your family lives. When you notice a flaw in somebody, the first person you should look at for that flaw is yourself. Right? Like, let's say, for example, I notice, you know, my son, for example, my son is not baligh yet, but he's at that age where I'm training him to learn how to pray. Let's say I notice that in his prayer he's not paying attention. Okay? The first criticism I should have is of myself and say that, wait a minute, am I not somebody whose attention, you know, like lapses in prayer? That's a reminder for me that I need to work on myself. Let's say I see my spouse, you know, for example, she is, you know, getting angry, you know, in a situation, getting upset at something that she shouldn't. My first response should be to say that, wait, don't I do the same thing? Isn't that a way of God showing me and pointing out to me the flaws that I have? And that's one of the incredible ways that we can actually be in the path of improving ourselves. One of the ahadith of Imam Ali, it's very, you know, powerful. He says that the biggest flaw that somebody can have is to see the flaws of others and to not be able to recognize their own flaws. So this is one, is to provide that loving and that care, that love and that care, so that we can then be in the position to guide somebody and correct their flaws, you know, on occasion, and being very careful in doing so. Number two is to provide an environment where this tarbiyah and where this proper growth and proper spiritual excellence can be developed. When we put our children, for example, when you put them into an environment where they're being exposed to a lot of other ideologies, a lot of mistruths, a lot of bad influences, and then we expect from them that, okay, you know, I want you to be like this, and this. Isn't it a bit of a dichotomy? You know, one brother was telling me that sometimes it's like, you know, you put on a pure white, you know, clothes on a child and you tell them to go in a muddy field and tell them that don't get a single speck of that mud on your clothes. It's a bit difficult, isn't it? Right? So this is a very important thing for, as parents, we need to think about this, that how can I provide an environment which is proper for my children to develop in? One of the things that personally I've observed when it comes to parents, you know, in North America, in Canada, in USA, is that there's a lot of imbalance in some of the parenting techniques that are used. And this is very important, that as a parent I need to be balanced. For example, I'll give you some example. One of the things that we're told is that as a parent, we need to make sure that we provide for our children. Okay, and this is obvious. As a parent, I want to make sure that I'm taking care of the needs of my child. Okay, that's great. But is everything that my child asks me for, is that a real need? Or is it the case that sometimes there's something my child asks me for that I determine is not actually a real need, actually it's something which is harmful for them? I was reading an article about Bill Gates. It was from 2017. Bill Gates, you know, you could say one of the fathers of modern technology. And he was saying in that article, they were interviewing him, he's saying that my children were asking me for their own phones, their own, you know, smartphones when they were children. And all their friends had them as well too. Now, he says that I didn't give it to them, and it wasn't because of a budget issue, I can guarantee you that. Okay. It's Bill Gates we're talking about here. It wasn't because of an inability to, like, you know, sort of identify which phone it was or something like that. It wasn't because he didn't know what a smartphone was. This is Bill Gates. But he says that as a parent, as parents, we realize that this phone is something which is damaging to our children when they're younger at that age. So even though they were clamoring for it, they were pressing us for it, their peers had it as well too, we said no. And unfortunately, we're at the point sometimes where brothers and sisters, I have to give the example of Bill Gates as somebody that we have to imitate. Right? That at least to that level of awareness that our children are demanding something from us, we need to say that, wait a minute, is this something which is a real need from a child? Is somehow going to be deprived of, you know, like an education, or deprived of being able to go closer to God because I didn't give them an iPhone, because I realize this is the device of Shaytan, that this is a device which has so much potential to misguide my children. One of the areas of, when it comes to balance, when it comes to children and parenting, is the example of authority and not giving authority. On one hand, we know that we have to give our children freedom. It's very important that we're not like those parents who are like absolute dictators, and we treat our children like soldiers who are, you know, in our army battalion. Look left, look right, or something like that. That's not the way it's supposed to be. But on the other hand, as a parent, my job is to also have limitations and have guidelines to be able to say that, no, this is where it stops. You have a certain amount of freedom, but not past this point. You have a bedtime. I'm going to be in charge of what friends you have. I'm going to know who you're going to communicate with. I'm not going to allow you to communicate with strangers online. I'm not going to allow you to go in environments where your beliefs are going to be tainted and where your akhlaq is going to be spoiled. I'm not going to be allowing you to expose yourself to media which is inappropriate. Right? And many other things as well too. But these are just two of the examples where we need to strike that balance. But the final thing I want to mention is that, brothers and sisters, in all of this, we talked about the idea of guiding others. But the most sure way of being able to guide others is to be the example that we want them to be. So whether it be as a parent, or whether it be as a spouse, whether it be as a son or a daughter, whether it be as a friend or an acquaintance, we need to show through our example of what it means to be on the sabil al-rashad, the path of righteousness. If I'm one of those adults who has stopped his education or her education of Islam, we're done with. You know, we're past that stage in life. I don't struggle when it comes to trying to extra worship Allah. I don't have any type of spiritual routine in my life. Right? I don't try extra hard to rein in my tongue and control it, to treat my spouse with respect. Then how can I ever give that example to my children and tell them and be somebody who guides them to the path of righteousness? These are some points that I'd like to offer for tonight. Again, just to recap, the message is one of having this goal when we interact with others of guiding them to the path of righteousness. This is the goal which is not just for the imam, but for the followers of the imams as well too. And something that should govern the way that we interact with others. Peace be upon Muhammad. Allah, Allah, Allah. Tonight we'd like to mention a few words of musibah regarding a very special child who was accompanying the caravan of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. What would it have been like along the journey when this young daughter of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, they say she was 3 years old or 4 years old. In some of the reports, her name is mentioned to be Ruqayya. What do you think it would have been like when she saw that her cousin Hamida, who is also a girl like her, that at one point in the journey she sees that Imam Hussein alayhi salam's eyes are flowing with tears, and he calls for her cousin to come and sit on his lap, and she's watching her father crying and stroking her cousin and telling her that, don't worry, that from now on your father has passed away, but from now on I will be your father. My sister will be your mother. My daughters will be your sisters. And my sons will be your brothers. And she's seeing this happen in front of her own eyes, that what does it mean to lose a father? Now she's an intelligent child. And she must be thinking that, what if I'm in that situation? And I am to lose my own father? Then what would happen to me? Who's left to then stroke my hair and to comfort me? This is the type of journey that Ruqayya is taking as she's going to Karbala. Imagine on the day of Ashura, as she's standing with her father, and her father is surveying the battlefield. And he looks at the bodies which have been slain, and they're now lying on the battlefield. You must have seen the body of his brother Abbas alayhi salam, the body of his son Ali Akbar, the body of his nephew Qasim. And she is watching her father. She must have seen the pain in his eyes. She must have seen him getting his sword ready for the battle, and now he is mounting his horse. And you know how young children are when they have a strong attachment to their father, especially the daughters. That when their father wants to leave the home, they don't want him to leave the home. And this is no ordinary departure here, brothers and sisters. This is the departure of a father where she knows that it might not be the case that he is to come back. This might be the last time she sees her father, and we're told that the children were hanging to the horse. They did not want it to let it go and to advance to the battlefield.
صلى الله عليك يا أبا عبد الله الحسين صلى الله عليك يا أيها المقتول عطشانا يا سفينة النجاة يا سيد الشهداء
Along the way to Karbala, there was a man named Abdullah ibn Hur al-Ju'fi. At one point, Imam Hussein alayhi salam goes to see him, but he takes along his children with him. Abdullah ibn Hur al-Ju'fi, when he sees Imam Hussein alayhi salam with his children, he sees the love between the father and his sons and his daughters. He makes a comment, he says that never before have I seen a family like this. I've never seen a more tender sight of love between a father and his children. My heart has never been broken the way I saw that Imam Hussein alayhi salam was dealing with his family. You can imagine the love that Ruqayya has for her Baba, for her father. We're told that when they entered Sham, they were put in a place which was very inappropriate, very difficult for the Ahlul Bayt. It was a ruined area which had no roof on it. In the daytime it would be so hot, in the nighttime it would be so cold. Imagine the suffering, the children who are wondering, when will this nightmare end? When will we see our fathers again? Where have they taken them? According to some reports, this young daughter of Imam Hussein alayhi salam sees a dream in which she remembers her father. She wakes up crying for him. She asks her auntie Zainab, where is my father? What answer can you give to a three-year-old who is asking for her father? What can you tell her about the truth of what happened to him? The ladies have no response to give to Ruqayya. The whole place is filled with their tears. According to some reports, Yazid la'natullahi alayhi hears the clamoring. He asks, what's wrong? They tell him that the daughter of Imam Hussein alayhi salam is missing her father. He says to them, then take this head to her. Perhaps this will quiet them down. Allow me to enjoy my sleep. They bring the head to the daughter. She asks them, what is this that you have brought to me? They unveil it. They tell her, don't you recognize it? It's the head of your father. When she sees it, she cannot hold back the tears. According to some reports, she cries out, "Oh, my father, ya abata, man alladhi khatabaka bidimaik. Oh, my father, who has dyed your beard with your blood? Oh, my father, man alladhi aytamani ala sighari sinni. Oh, my father, who is it that has made me an orphan, even though I am so young? This is too early for me to be an orphan." And when Ruqayya sees her father in that state, the emotion is so much, the difficulty is so much, that these are the last breaths that Ruqayya breathes in her life. فَلَا لَعْنَةُ اللَّهِ عَلَى الْقَوْمِ الظَّالِمِينَ وَسَيَعْلَمَ الَّذِينَ ظَلَمُوا أَيَّ مُنْقَلَبٍ يَنْقَلِبُونَ.